You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And Neil, I want to ask you about something that I think is like a little bit cryptic, but I'm sure there has to be a good story behind it. You have a Bezos paradox. Tell me about the Bezos paradox.
Well, I wanted to tell this story because I just wanted to do a load of name dropping and get to say that I once talked to Jeff. Okay, so let's just get that out of the way. So once I talked to Jeff. But actually, no, there's a serious thing that comes in. And so let me give you the background. So this before I was in my current job, I was invited to, when I was at University of Sheffield, so before I worked for Amazon, I was invited to speak at the Amazon Machine Learning Conference, which at that time was like 2,000 people. It's now like even bigger. I was giving a talk, this is like 2016, I think, on data-efficient learning. I was sort of saying, well, deep neural networks great, but you know, Gaussian processes are data efficient. That's kind of what I was saying. And Jeff was in the audience, Jeff Bezos. Actually, my favorite bit about that is the kind of no one knew he was there. He was hidden away. And there was a guy asking a question. They were like queuing for the microphones, and he's like queuing for the microphone behind this guy that's doing that thing. Yeah, like a real person. You know, he's generally, well, whenever I've seen him, he kind of seems, he tries to be a real person. If you've ever been at Neurips and someone's like queuing for a question and like they're going on for their question for quite a long time, sort of like you're sort of giving the answer and then they keep doing follow-ups and thinking, this guy's taking a while at the mic. I don't know, it felt to me, now I can't, because of course it's a sort of thing, because I'm standing there thinking, oh, there's Jeff Bezos about to ask a question behind this guy. And this guy's like oblivious. And he's sort of talking on some detailed thing. On slide 3, you had a factor of half. And I'm like, slide 3. So anyway, the guy finishes. And Jeff asks his question. And Jeff's question was something like, it was about power efficiency. He said, well, the human brain operates off the power roughly of a light bulb or something like that, which I think is true. So of course, I said, that's a very good question. That's an excellent question. I can't remember what I sort of said, oh, yeah, no, that's interesting too. And power efficiency. I did some fumbling answer because I didn't have any. Anyway, afterwards, in the break, we had a chance to have a quick chat. The funny thing, at this point, everyone knew Jeff was there. So everyone was taking selfies with him, like from the entire company. Anyway, I get sort of swung up to him and he says, oh, thanks. That was a really nice talk. And he said something about, he said, so can you get power efficiency for these models by like using low precision? And I said, no, actually with Gaussian processes, we even need double precision quite often. I mean, we can sometimes get away with single, particularly we need double precision to deal with the algorithms. And I'd been pushing a lot the ability of the Gaussian process to deal with uncertainty. And I'd been pushing the idea, which I kind of believe in. So it's good that I believe in something I've been pushing. But the uncertainty was very important for data efficiency. I believe in that. So Jeff sort of says, he goes, oh, that's funny, because you said that Gaussian processes handle uncertainty and neural networks don't. But now the parameters of neural networks, you can get away with lower precision. And you're saying that with Gaussian processes, you can't. And I was like, So I thought about that a lot, because I think of it now as the Bezos paradox, because he pointed out to me. Maybe other people have pointed out before, but good luck in calling it the Smith paradox or something else. And I think it's a very interesting aspect. It's something that's very challenging for Gaussian process models. I think there are some interesting solutions, but and perhaps other models where when you're doing variational methods, you're actually, so what I think is going on here is the approximations I was talking about are either not approximations, you know, you're either trying to do the exact inverse, and or when you're doing certain variational approximations, it turns out that to fit the distribution, what you're doing is you're moving a distribution around latent space. And I'm sure there's no sort of rule associated with this, but if you're actually trying to fit the distribution, it seems that when you're doing your optimization, you need to resolve it with very high precision. Because if you don't resolve it with very high precision, you're trying to jointly fit this mean and covariance, you can often get stuck in like these plateau areas that somehow you may have made your optimization harder by moving this whole distribution around and trying to fit it with high precision. And it always, because it interests me a lot, this came up in the MLSS a lot. People were like David Bly and Shakir Mohammed were both banging a drum that I used to bang a lot, and I still believe in, but I don't need to bang it when everyone else is banging it, about separation of model and algorithm. Like, you think about your model, you think about your algorithm together. But this is a counterexample where that becomes quite dangerous, I think. So neural networks sort of conflate model and algorithm. And I think you get away with the lack of precision because you're not trying to fit a distribution. Because the sort of surfaces, they're so badly determined, but you can kind of, it sort of doesn't matter where you end up to a fine level of precision. I don't think I'm explaining that too well. It's sort of like, if you think about the surface, okay, so sure, there's uncertainty in the Gaussian process, and you're trying to cater for that uncertainty. But in terms of your optimization, because you're moving a distribution around in that certain space, when you think about your variational methods, I think you're converting, if your optimization function, if your optimization problem has a very large basin of attraction to start with, if you were doing the non-Bayesian thing, once you do the Bayesian thing, so large basin of attraction, I mean that like it's kind of, you easily get somewhere near the minima by dropping yourself in anywhere. But once you start moving a large distribution around this space, you are now optimizing the parameters of that distribution. So your new optimization function potentially has a very sort of narrow basin of attraction. It's quite hard to find the optimum. And that's why you need to go for very high precision. Whereas if you don't do the Bayesian thing and you just drop yourself in there, then you sort of get somewhere roughly near the mid. So like you don't get, like you maybe you get the location of the optima right within half a standard deviation of where you should be if you were doing the full Bayesian thing. But that's still good enough. But if you're doing the full Bayesian thing, if you get your maxima within half a optima right, I mean, you've got your variances all over the place. You're trying to jointly maximize these things or minimize these things. It's a bit of a mess. I think that the answers come, I think things like stochastic variational inference that may help a lot, but it's something that I've, so stochastic variational inference is, well, I'm not sure if it helps. I mean, that's something I'm even confused about whether that actually helps. Maybe it's just the large amount of data that helps, but I'm not sure if there's anything hard and fast about this, but it struck me as very, very interesting. And maybe everyone now has amazing papers where they can get away with 8 bits and 32 bits on Gaussian process modeling, but I just don't think they do. And until they do, these methods are going to struggle, because what you're going to see happening now is there are hardware companies specifically designing hardware to deal with the sort of operations you need for neural networks. So whether or not that's the ultimate right thing, that's what's going to be produced. So you're going to have mobile phones with like specialized perhaps 16-bit hardware for fitting neural networks or predicting from neural networks. And if you can't work out a way of turning your algorithm into something that sits on that architecture, you're going to be in trouble. So unless we can resolve the Bezos paradox, you know, it's going to be hard for people that have algorithms that require these sort of high precision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we will find more people thinking about this Bezos paradox, and we will have links to their research or thinking.
Maybe it's someone else to resolve. People will be like, we get thousands of mails saying, I talked about that in 1946. You know, I already fixed this. You know,
you don't even worry about it. If you fixed the Bezos paradox, you can get us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com. And we would love to put whatever you fixed up on our website, which is thetalkingmachines.com.
Yeah. Solve the Bezos paradox.
So this week's listener question on Talking Machines is about NeurIPS. Neil, what was your best paper for NeurIPS 2018? Did you have a favorite? Was there something that really stood out to you, a poster or something you saw in a workshop that you thought was like amazing?
It was so, I was kind of blown away by, again, every year I am, I find it hard to take it all in. I'm very impressed by the diversity of things that are going on. I actually find it harder and harder to get to grips with a paper when like there's a lot of people around the poster. So I know like a lot of the papers that you know about, like the neural ODE machines and stuff like that, I think are very cool, and sort of people have been known about them before the conference, and that's funny because a lot of stuff's on archive now. I guess over this recent period, the paper that I get a lot out of small workshops where I get to hear the authors present, and at the DALI meeting, I was very struck by work that Suchi Saria was talking about. She wasn't actually at Neurips, but I think maybe an earlier version was there, or maybe at one of the workshops. But anyway, it is accepted for AI stats, which is in Japan. Speaking of, we've been talking about conferences going places. It's in Japan, which is great. Okay, so I saw the presentation, and there's what she's looking at is sort of important for data set shift and fairness and other things, but I don't think that they're making as broad a claims for their work as I'm going to make for this general direction in the paper, but I just thought it was a really useful start in that direction. So she was sort of pushing the generative model behind a disease. She's trying to look at the sort of situation where, I think it was the example she used was asthma attacks. And you've got certain things, if we think of like Pearl, classical Pearl, sort of probabilistic graphs, sort of they can be caused by not taking your inhaler, or they can be caused by smoking or something like that. What I thought was interesting about her work, which is with her student whose name escapes from, we'll put that, make sure that's on the website, was that she brought in this notion, and maybe people have similar notions, but of stable and unstable links in the graph. Now, let me try and explain why I think this is important. The stable links were sort of links that Tsuchi believed would always apply regardless of conditions. So something like smoking affects asthma. And then unstable links were things like outside influences that might vary in different places, like whether or not people are taking their inhaler. That might vary in one place or another according to policy or maybe distribution of inhalers. I'm sure it's much better explained in the details of the paper, but it's just giving you the summary of that. Now, what was interesting and what they try and do in the paper is augment the graphical models, or succeed in doing, with additional variables that allow you to ask counterfactuals regardless of the unstable links. So meaning that you've augmented the graph in such a way that you can ask a counterfactual question and deal with the confounding variables. So these unstable links are now sort of considered confounding variables, and have an algorithm that is robust to deployment in cases where the unstable link is not operating as it did in your original training data. So that gives you that's related very closely to data set shift. Importantly, okay, and I think that this is a really interesting trend we're seeing. Often when people are now talking about causal inference, I think in the old days, it was very much, I'm going to fit my directed graphical model. But in this paper and a lot of others you're seeing, the graph is sort of the inspiration for what the algorithm should be. So I think once you've introduced these augmented variables, you actually fit you fit various conditional distributions directly with your deep neural network, your Gaussian process, whatever you want to do. Now, I think that that's super interesting, and it may be just the sort of just the one paper I've seen that's part of a broad number of works. So apologies if I'm missing other work in this space, but we'd love to hear about it. Why do I find this very, very interesting and important? I think that we really struggle with our modeling because we have to specify everything. What do I mean by that? I mean that if we're trying to look into the future, one of the things, a technique that I think is very effective, is not to say what's going to happen, but to say what's not going to happen. Like, again, actually, Bezos does this. His quotes are famous. I don't know what the future is going to look like, but I don't think people want to pay more for stuff. I don't know what the future is looking like, but I don't think that they'll want to wait longer. It seems sensible. You're sort of saying, oh, it's not going to be a world where people want to pay more. And I think that that's a very useful technique, you know, to sort of almost specify constraints on the future rather than specify everything. Now, probabilistic models and a lot of models we create just try and specify everything. You don't get to sort of say it's going to be like this and everything else is going to be left to its own devices. You kind of have to specify every variable in the graph. Now, Tsuchi's work, and it excited me a great deal, not just because it's interesting work in the application, but it's pointing a way forward at that. Because in effect, when you look at what she's saying about stable links in the graph versus unstable links, she's saying, oh, this part can vary, that I can model this other thing here, and I can, you know, and that other confounder, that can do any stuff, but I've got a way of dealing with that. Now, whether the approach she's taking is going to be the right way of dealing with this in general, But the point is, you're sort of hinting towards a sort of domain where instead of specifying your entire graphical model to specify your system, you're expressing part of your graph. You're saying, oh, there's this conditional independence relationship for only these X number of variables. There's other stuff going on, and I think it's like this. But, you know, there's this part here. And what can I say about the future with this strong constraint on part of the graph? So it's like, the, you know, other stuff may happen, but this part of the graph is constrained to look like this. It feels like, I don't know, just a crack into that. I'm not saying it's giving us the whole direction, and I haven't had time to sit down and go through it in detail. And I don't really need to, because Suchi's doing it, right? That's the great thing about our community. I don't have to run around chasing everyone.
Because Suchi's doing it. It's fantastic.
Well, it's like, it's one of the things that is tied to, that's classically one of my approaches. Like, if really bright people are doing something really, really interesting that you think is important, you don't have to compete with them. You could just let them do it.
It sounds like a very energy efficient way to do exploration of a space.
You could just be pleased that other people are doing stuff. If it's like you think I need to mow my lawn and someone else is mowing your lawn, you just think, oh, no, you don't have to rush out there and mow the last part of it before they get there. You could just let them to continue to mow the lawn. Go, you can go, like, I don't know, weed the flower beds.
This was cooperative approach. Yeah, I like it.
Oh, it's definitely, I don't know, because I do think sometimes in the community at the moment, it's like, oh, someone's done this, we must all rush and do that.
Yeah, no.
You don't have to, someone's doing it. Someone's doing it already. You can relax. I know it's not entirely like that, and it's frustrating when you're on the cusp of doing something and someone else does it for you. But I think a little bit more of the, like, I mean, I do find that interesting. If I found a use for it in something specific I'm doing right now, I would be all over it. But I'm trying to be more problem-driven. But it's just great to know that these sort of techniques are being developed.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will have a link to Learning Predictive Models That Transport, Suchi's paper by Subbaswamy, Shulam, and Saria, up on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. And if you've got a question, or if you had a favorite paper at DALI or NeurIPS or somewhere you've been lately, let us know at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com. And you can tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS.
This week's guest on Talking Machines is Dougal McLaurin of Google Brain. And when we got a chance to sit down with Dougal, we asked him the first question we ask all of our guests. How did you get where you are?
It's been a little bit roundabout. So I started out in physics, which is actually a surprisingly conventional place to start for a machine learning person. I did my undergrad in Australia at the University of Melbourne, and I came to the US in 2010 to study physics at Harvard. I started out not in machine learning. I actually started out in a biophysics lab, in Adam Cohen's lab, doing sort of experimental photophysics, really. It was actually, it was an amazing time. I spent 2 years in that lab, and even as a machine learning person now, it's quite a formative experience. So I could even describe a little bit about what I did, did there.
And also, how does someone doing experimental photophysics end up in a bio lab?
Well, it's a biophysics lab, and in a sense, I was focused on instrumentation, so sort of building microscopes and spectrometers and sort of taking careful measurements of these fluorescent proteins. Yeah, so Adam's lab has discovered this fluorescent protein archaeorhodopsin, and it sits in the cell membrane of a neuron or any other cell that you can put it into. And it fluoresces, so you can see it under the microscope. And importantly, its fluorescence is responsive to voltage, so you can look at this thing and see when the neuron's firing. So it's a way of optically reading out neural activity. Yeah, so it's an amazing little piece of technology. And I was building instruments to study the sort of spectral and electrical properties of this fluorescent protein. I was doing that for 2 years, finished the project I'd been working on. So we characterized the sort of three-photon process that was involved in voltage sensitivity of this microbial rhodopsin. And then I was looking at sort of what was going to be the next sort of natural step. And it was clear that sort of pursuing that line of work was going to involve getting deeper and deeper into biology, which wasn't really my home turf, but was certainly interesting in its own right. But in the meantime, I'd actually started getting very interested in machine learning. So with several friends, started, you know, listening to the old Coursera videos. Also had some friends in Ryan Adams' lab, and they were having a great time. And actually, in my sort of experimental photophysics work, the part that I was actually enjoying the most was really analyzing data. So we got these amazing data sets coming off our rigs, high dimensional data. You have time and input spectrum and output spectrum, and these are all our videos as well. So you have two dimensional resolution. There are just so many ways you can slice and dice this data and look at it in different ways. I decided that there maybe I'd try to actually remodel myself as more of a sort of data science-y, software engineering sort of person. And machine learning was almost going to be my backdoor into that. That somehow it'd be hard to be taken seriously as a physicist doing software engineering, but maybe there's a path in machine learning. And I never imagined that actually machine learning would be the thing that would that I'd end up really enjoying, but also that would be so popular and sort of sought after today. But yeah, so I made the hard decision to change fields in the middle of my PhD there and join Ryan's lab. It was a fantastic time I had after that. So it was a sort of golden period in Ryan's group. There were just so many great researchers doing a real range of different things. That's how I got into machine learning.
Did you continue to work on the rhodopsin data sets when you were in Ryan's labs, or did you?
I didn't so much. No, we'd closed up that we'd finished that particular project. So all that data we'd analyzed it and sort of put that aside. In Ryan's group, I was really doing a sort of raw methods development. So I started out doing some Markov chain Monte Carlo. The work we wrote a little paper called Firefly Monte Carlo, which was about sort of subsampling data sets and still doing sort of like asymptotically exact MCMC inference. I worked on a project sort of maybe more related to physics-y chemistry stuff, trying to predict the properties of organic molecules from their structure. There was actually in collaboration with the Harvard Chemistry Department with the Linus Berhuis's group. We were looking at organic LEDs and organic photovoltaics and trying to predict their properties. But somehow the project that actually I think had the most impact was a little side project that I started one weekend as a sort of proof of concept, and this was an automatic differentiation project. So it was in the service of this project to predict the properties of organic molecules. We wanted to build these elaborate neural networks that took different organic molecules, so different graph topologies as inputs, and it was quite a hard thing to express with the tools of the time. And so started this project called Autograd. Actually, originally it was called Funky Yak, which was a terrible name, and luckily that's been sort of banished history. But we eventually named it Autograd, and that became this sort of software package that people started to use.
Yeah, and it's had a huge impact.
I think it has had some modest impact. One funny sort of impact that it's had is actually it's been successful enough that it's become a generic term. So Autograd is the package that we wrote is all about tracing, and tracing meaning tracking the sort of transformations that are applied to input values of a function as they get transformed into the output values of a function, and by doing that, differentiating the function. But the name Autograd has somehow been a sort of meta tracer where various different projects have started using it as a generic term, including PyTorch and MXNet and so on. So we can recognize that maybe there was some influence of the Vera system on those just by the name becoming generic. One of our collaborators on Autograd, Matt Johnson, sort of says that the biggest mistake of his life was having Autograd be named with a lowercase a instead of an uppercase a.
So you basically become Kleenex.
I mean, it was a pretty canonical name to begin with, so maybe it was presumptuous of us to sort of stake a claim for that real estate.
Excellent. So tell me more about the questions that you were really excited about in Adams's lab.
In Ryan Adams' lab, I really worked on many different projects. So I was originally interested in the sort of methods development, and so that's what led to this work in MCMC. But increasingly, and I think that's sort of where I am now, I started getting interested in this problem of sort of how to express machine learning models and generally how to sort of express data analyses sort of more easily and in a way that lets you iterate more quickly on ideas. And so that was the motivation behind Autograd, and it's the motivation of my work today at Google as well. It's how can you make it as simple as possible to express what's in your head and in code.
We'll talk more about the other stuff that you've been doing in a minute, but let's talk about the work that you've been doing at Google Brain. You recently came over to Google Brain, and you're working on this project, I believe it's called JAX, yeah?
That's right, yeah. JAX, which stands for... It originally stood for just after execution, so there's the idea of a just-in-time, a JIT compiler, and just after execution was a sort of joke that you could compile after executing the function. So JAX sort of stemmed from Autograd. It was an observation of Matt Johnson very early in the development of Autograd, which was that we're building this representation of a computation for the purposes of differentiating it, but you could just as easily use that same representation to compile the function and then have it run fast on accelerators. So one of the big things holding Autograd back, I think it had some successful ideas, but as a software artifact, it was never able to do anything other than run on a CPU. And of course, deep learning is all about exploiting modern, highly parallel accelerators. And so not being able to run on GPU or even Google's TPUs was always a big limitation. So JAX addresses that limitation by compiling Python programs, Python functions, by specializing them to particular shapes, then just-in-time compiling them via XLA so they can run on these different accelerators. That's the first pass at JAX's Autograd plus GPUs and TPUs. What we've discovered more generally is that there's all sorts of program transformations you want to be able to make on your program. In traditional computer science, programmers write programs, and then compilers get to transform them into other programs, usually an equivalent program, but at a lower level. But actually, when you're doing numerical computing, there are all sorts of transformations that you as the user want to control. So automatic differentiation is a great example of that. But even things like Bayesian inference is another example, or even optimization, which is the sort of core thing that we do in machine learning. All these things are much easier if you have access to the program like as a piece of data that you can manipulate. And so JAX, at a more philosophical level, is a system for transforming Python programs in a way that's sort of composable and very flexible.
That's amazing. I mean, that sounds huge.
I think it could be very powerful. It is just the very, very beginning. There are certainly lots of limitations as it currently stands. Just as certainly some of the ideas in Autograd have made their way into more sort of mainstream systems like PyTorch and TensorFlow, Eager both have their auditif sort of loosely based around Autograd. We hope that this research project JAX can also lead to a world where we can readily do program transformations composably and in user space.
Nice. And the release was a couple of months ago, right?
That's right. So actually at NeurIPS, we were hacking in a cafe for most of the conference. We eventually we eventually put it up on GitHub, and it seems to be of interest to some people, at least up there.
That's fantastic. So do you have any hopes or plans for it for the next evolution, or are you just trying to like find and squash all the bugs right now?
To be honest, we're actually not really in bug squashing mode, partly because it is deliberately a research project, and there will be bugs, and sort of the people who are willing to use it, I think, are tolerant of them and often actually squash them themselves. I think we're always interested in pushing it forward and trying out the next thing. So one of the big things at the moment is just distribution, that we can take advantage of one GPU, but take advantage of many GPUs or TPUs or sort of larger systems. Program transformation is a great way to think about that problem as well. And so getting a nice distributed story is one of the near-term goals.
Fantastic. So what other questions are you really excited about here at Google Brain?
So I'd definitely say that having moved from physics into machine learning and now working on JAX and Autograd, my current interests really are more about sort of programming languages and how to express numerical programs than they are in traditional machine learning. So I'd keep on working on JAX and sort of related projects for a time. There's a much sort of bigger picture than machine learning, which is maybe loosely described as data science or even numerical data analysis, high dimensional data analysis. And I think there's actually a lot of scope for programming languages ideas to just make it much easier to ask the questions that you need to ask in order to make discoveries. I think back to my time at Adam Cohen's lab doing microscopy experiments, and also my time at Azure Diagnostics analyzing genomic data. And so often you're bound by the amount of time it takes to take a question you have in your head about your data and the time it takes to implement that as a software artifact that you can execute. And if you can make that time as short as possible, then it makes the whole process of science much, much faster. And I think it genuinely enables you to make discoveries at a rate that you actually couldn't otherwise.
Absolutely. And having the idea of a language that's truly fungible would I think make a lot of progress in terms of replicability and just like information sharing. It seems like a really big roadblock that, if cleared, might change the way that the field
absolutely
works.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's a huge range of questions to answer, like that reproducibility and sort of clarity of what you're doing. If your program is very obfuscated because of all the sort of technical limitations of the programming language, then it becomes hard to even know if it's correct, right? And as so much of science is based on fairly sophisticated analyses of large data sets, it becomes even more important to have the sort of analytical question be as clear as it can be in code, not just for writing it, but also, as you say, for reading it. Yeah.
Absolutely. You mentioned Day Zero Diagnostics, which was a startup you had. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So actually, after grad school, I started this company, Day Zero Diagnostics, with my wife, another close friend from grad school, and my wife's PhD advisor and an old college friend of his, called Day Zero Diagnostics. So my wife, Melissa Anatar, she's an MD PhD, and during her PhD, she studied the vaginal microbiome. So she studied the role of vaginal bacteria in HIV acquisition and other things like that. And she did a lot of sequencing of bacteria. So a lot of her work was taking samples and doing shotgun sequencing to discover what's in there and sort of looking at that data. And there was this sort of there was this paradox where it was very easy and fast to sequence bacteria and see what's in it. And yet in the clinic, in order to discover what bacteria somebody's infected with, you actually have to culture the bacteria for days in order to see what a person has. And so drug treatment decisions are made really in the dark, without any of this information at all. And so the sort of premise of day zero diagnostics was let's get you the diagnostic information at day zero just by sequencing what's in your blood or sputum. And so that was the idea. Her PhD advisor, Doug Kwan, is a clinician, and so he was sort of painfully aware of the clinical problem. And so the two of them brought on board me and Miriam to handle the data analysis side of things. So even if you can sequence the bacteria quickly, actually understanding what those genomes mean is not totally trivial, because you have to it's reasonably easy to understand what species of bacteria a person's infected with, but understand the antibiotic resistance is a much harder problem. And so this mapping, even though there exists such a mapping from genotype to phenotype, it's a classic hard problem. And we understand it in only such limited cases. So the approach there was going to be a machine learning one, which is just that if we could collect enough samples where we know the genome and we've done the phenotypic antibiotic susceptibility tests, then we can build a model that predicts one from the other. The five of us started out working on that. And that company is still going very strong. So we actually recently closed a Series A round led by Tri Ventures, which was nice. There's 8.6 million, and that should fund us for some time. And it's really going from strength to strength. So Miriam's the CTO now, and she just does a superb job of technical leadership, running the company's sort of research and development. And Zhang Li is our CEO, and he does a superb job of managing the business side of the company. So I left Day Zero a year ago to start at Google Brain. It was again a very hard decision. This opportunity to, as I mentioned before, take Autograd, which had been this sort of modestly successful project, but always held back by its sort of lack of acceleration and GPU capabilities, and sort of take that for the next generation into Jax. I left to join Brain in January of last year. On a sort of practical level, my wife and I also had a baby, and so that I think factored into the decision a little bit. But she's great.
That's great, excellent. And so I think a lot of people in the field right now are really excited about the idea of direct collaboration with people who are not experts in their field but have access to data, right. Huge piles. Yeah. And starting a startup with one's wife and her advisor and your other friends from grad school seems like a super intense collaborative experience.
It was super intense. It was super fun, and it still is. So I'm still involved at least as a consultant, and it's just amazing the pace of things in a startup. Certainly, it was very intense in the early days. There were times we were even doing experiments out of our kitchen in our apartment with supplies that we'd ordered from Amazon. When you have a close relationship with your wife, and then you're also working together, it's very intense, but also extremely rewarding. We were just nonstop thinking and living and breathing this company and this idea, and it was very fun.
That's awesome. Did you learn anything about speaking clinician in working on this project?
Yeah, you definitely pick up a bit of the lingo and jargon. It's a funny thing where it's actually a problem that didn't take any selling at all to physicians. It's so recognized as a problem, the slowness of diagnosing bacteremias, that actually on the clinical side, there's very little convincing. It's more a question of, can we get the science and technology to the point where it's reliable and fast enough. And we think we can, but it'll take some time.
Nice. Fantastic. Excellent. So let's return to your work at Google Brain. You're excited about working on these questions around language. Where else do you feel like we're going to see sort of big leaps and bounds? Or are there other big roadblocks that you feel like need to be jumped before we can sort of make movement on this larger fungible language question?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Languages, there are many, many ways to answer it. Languages are I think, surprisingly easy to create and implement. Always the challenge is getting adoption. So it's certainly a big ask to imagine that people will switch from their Python and R or even Julia in the near term. But I think it's still important to try to imagine what an ideal language might look like, and then maybe those ideas can be sort of backported to existing languages, or maybe not. There's also a sort of related programming languages for machine learning. There's also maybe sort of machine learning for programming languages, or maybe programming languages as machine learning, which is another topic that is, it's always of interest, but again, quite a hard one, which is that programs are in some sense the ultimate model, right? Like they're the most, you know, modular, composable, expressive thing that you can possibly imagine. And so there's always this dream, this sort of holy grail of program induction as the ideal way to do inference and to build models. And that's something I always I'm always tempted to think about working on. It's also very hard. Had that problem that seems intractable in many ways, but there are sort of limited versions of the problem, which is just to make sort of composable grammars of models and work with them rather than a fully fledged programming language.
Do you think that we'll get to a point where we have that?
I certainly hope so. Yeah, I mean, but I honestly don't know
exactly. We'll need the next Ilya Sutskever to just like think really hard about it and then have the answer.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, totally. So Dougal, we talked a little bit about replicability and sort of fungibility of ideas. And that really brings up for me the experimental approach in machine learning. And I think we see sort of two kind of different cultures, the sort of traditional computer science culture, but maybe as more and more collaboration takes place, we see sort of a more traditional scientific, like sort of experimentally rigorous approach to building these models come up. Do you see that? Do you have sort of thoughts about the way that that's headed?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's this funny historical accident, which is that machine learning is really statistics as grown out of computer science departments in one sense. And computer science is a wonderfully rich field. And it has sort of two schools, I think, roughly being very glib. There's a sort of theoretical analysis school of theoretical computer science, and then there's a more sort of practical engineering school. Whereas actually machine learning is neither of those. It's a deeply empirical experimental field, right? We have very few theoretical tools for understanding how neural nets and other things work. So we try different things and see what works. And that's totally fine. Empirical science is a great thing, but it needs to be done with a little bit of care and even creativity almost more than care. So I actually feel very grateful for having some sort of experimental science background where I just think about in biology and in experimental physics and chemistry, just the amount of effort people put into building careful instruments to answer particular questions, the creativity of trying to take a large system and sort of break it into its components and study them individually, sort of break a phenomenon down to the smallest possible experimental system that reproduces that phenomenon. I think we could definitely learn some lessons there in machine learning, whereas the current standard is more or less to treat the entire thing as a big black box, measure one number at the very end, which is some sort of cross-validation loss, then have a small table of numbers that summarizes it. So I think the field's moving in that direction, and I'm very excited to see more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like that if that approach was sort of more standard, we might also be able to get around this phenomenon of rediscovery that seems to happen a lot, where people are sort of like accidentally rediscovering something that's been around since the 60s, but maybe we didn't have enough compute power to actually make it go. It feels like that might be something that would help us get around that.
I do think there is a problem in science and in general, that ideas come in and out of fashion, and so I think there's always going to be some amount of rediscovery as technologies change. I definitely think that we'll have a lot more confidence in the things that we do discover if we can do careful experiments to show them. Whereas, as you mentioned, this sort of reproducibility crisis, it can be very hard to have any faith in these empirical discoveries if they're not done sort of carefully and with enough thought.
Yeah. So what would you advise to someone, say they're still in graduate school, they're really excited, they're in an awesome lab, they don't have any other, this is their scientific background, they don't have any other exposure to collaborators. How would you suggest to them that they start in this sort of a mode of thinking to approach their experimentation?
Yeah, that's a really good question and a hard question. In some ways, it is about culture, and that's a hard thing to sort of change consciously. I think there are two directions or modes of thinking that I'd like to see more of. One is just as a sort of baseline, being more careful about experiments. So in biology, I think biology is the science where things are most black box, in the sense that at the extreme we do drug experiments on people and all you see is what you put in and what you get out. And in those cases, doing careful science is about, so some of it's about p-values and those sort of statistical questions, but more than that, it's about having careful controls. And biologists just live and breathe controls. It's always, did you try it with the thing on and off? And did you do other experiments where you know what the outcome should be just to prove that you know, everything is sort of sane? And so and I think the machine learning systems that people study these days are as mysterious and sort of complicated and well, maybe not as complicated, but certainly as unknown as biological systems. And so I think at the very least, that philosophy of having controls and having positive and negative controls and sanity checks that your whole setup works end to end, that's very important. The second thing is less tangible, but it's about somehow being creative in the questions you ask and not just asking the end-to-end questions, right? Before we do drug trials, we study individual proteins and individual cellular pathways, and we really try our best to break things down into the smaller system that we can. Whereas these days in machine learning, I think people tend to assume that the only experiment worth running is one that takes multiple weeks on multiple GPUs. Whereas I think if we can have a small model with a small amount of data that runs in a minute that still reproduces the phenomenon that we're trying to study, then we can do much better science and we can ask more interesting questions. So I'd like to see people try to do that more.
I also really love the idea of learning from biologists. So maybe just find someone in a different department to follow around.
Absolutely right. Just make friends. That's an excellent point. I mean, I honestly, I have almost no biological background except that I'm married to a biologist and have many friends who are. And yeah, even just the picking up on language and norms is very helpful.
Thank you so much, Dougal. This has been fantastic.
Great. Thank you so much, Katie. Great.
Dougal McLaurin, currently at Google Brain. And we'll have links to some of the other projects that he's been involved with on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. Well, that's it for this episode of Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.